Hello, everyone. Welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, July 27th. Kevin Rogers at the microphone. Glad to have you listening as always. A very warm day in Fort Dodge. I hope everyone's taking good care of themselves and staying cool, staying inside where the air conditioning is chilly and the fans are running and all those good things. There's some relief at the end of the week, according to the weather forecast. But for the next couple of days, it's going to be awfully hot in the Fort Dodge area and actually throughout the entire state of Iowa. So you want to take good care of yourselves. In the meantime, let's go ahead and take a look at today's messenger. Reg Bry Rides Again is the title of the first article, as 15,000 cyclists descend on Fort Dodge. With an excessive heat warning and temperatures already rising at 9 a.m. Monday, Ed Movic decided it was the perfect time to cool off with a cherry snow cone as he walked around Callander. Movic of Hendersonville, North Carolina, was one of more than 15,000 cyclists making their way across Iowa for Reg Bry 43 this week. The bike ride started Sunday morning in Lamar's before heading to Sac City for an overnight stop Monday night. Monday morning, the cyclists packed up and hit the road, heading 67.5 miles east, making stops in Lytton, Yetter, Lake City, Reinerd, Callander, and Moreland before heading into Fort Dodge for the second overnight stop. Movic, like other cyclists who stopped in Callander, walked around checking out the vendor booths and enjoying the small-town hospitality from community members. The purple stuff eagle attached to the top of his helmet was his constant companion. "I bought it in Eagle Grove on my first Reg Bry," he said. The eagle rides with him for every Reg Bry now. Movic said he's only missed 1 year of the bike ride, and that was because his daughter was getting married. "I like that I wake up when I want to. I can do what I want, and no one's telling me what to do," he said of his motivation for doing the 400-mile bike ride each summer. For Michelle and Rob Traer of Stewart's Draft, Virginia, Reg Bry is an anniversary of sorts. The couple met for the first time in Rolfe while riding Reg Bry 2007. "We've been married for 10 years, Rob said. The Traers continued riding Reg Bry for a few years but stopped about a decade ago. They decided to make the trip out west once again this summer for Reg Bry 43. I enjoy biking all day and the people," Michelle said, "and the small towns and how they welcome you." The Traers ride with the Tall Dogs Cycling Club from Des Moines during the week-long ride, but back in Virginia, they spend time riding in the Shenandoah Valley. "We like the miles, but some Reg Bry riders don't train at all," Rob said. "They don't have any miles in. We've already ridden 4,000 miles this year." Chris Mayer of Melbourne has completed 8 Reg Bry rides. "I just love doing it," he said. "It's a challenge every year." While the 454 miles and 11,954 feet of climb of the ride's route make up much of the challenge of Reg Bry, this year the oppressive heat with temperatures rising to nearly 100 on Wednesday greatly adds to that challenge, but Mayer has a plan. "For me, it's plenty of water, plenty of sleep, and no alcohol," he said. Nancy Clatt of Charles City felt Monday's 67 miles of distance and 996 feet of climb from Sac City to Fort Dodge was a piece of cake compared to Sunday's 84 miles of distance and 2,681 feet of climb from Lamar's to Sac City. "Today seemed like a breeze," she said. "Yesterday was brutal. It was 94 degrees. It was a long, hot day." Monday's ride route also included a lot of good beer stops, she added. Clatt was riding with friend Kush Chandak of Minneapolis. The pair enjoyed people watching during the Reg Bry stops. "The best part of going through small towns and actually talking with the local people and meeting new people and making connections," Chandak said. Clatt said she was impressed with the city of Fort Dodge and the entertainment area down Central Avenue in downtown Fort Dodge, acknowledging all the time and effort that goes into planning and organizing an overnight stop. "It's the volunteers that make the difference," she said. "It doesn't go unnoticed. We do know it takes a lot of work to make this happen." The more than 15,000 Reg Bry riders and their crews will be packing up and hitting the road this morning. Today's ride is almost 55 miles of distance and just over 1,000 feet of climb to Iowa Falls. The riders will pass through Duncombe, Webster City, Blairsburg, Williams, and Alden. There's lots of pictures associated with this article. There's a picture with the gentleman who has the eagle on his helmet. There's a picture of Calendar, where there are lots of bicyclists checking out the various tents of things that are for sale, things to eat, and so forth. There's a picture of several bicyclists riding into Calendar. And there's a picture of a lot of people. Most of them are walking. A few are on bicycles, walking down Central Avenue in Fort Dodge. And lots of other bicycle pictures. People having a good time eating snow cones and things like that. And the parking meters could be near. Fort Dodge is talking about getting rid of parking meters. They had them, they got rid of them, they got them back, and now they might get rid of them again. A plan to remove the parking meters from downtown streets will be considered by the Fort Dodge City Council tonight. The proposal calls for pulling out the meters and then allowing people to park in those on-street spots for free for up to 2 hours. People can actually park in those spots now for up to 2 hours for free thanks to a COVID-19 stimulus package approved by the council last year. That package also made parking in all downtown lots free. The council will begin its work at 5 o'clock with a workshop discussion on the proposed downtown parking plan. The council's regular business meeting begins at 6. The workshop and the meeting will be held at the municipal building at 819 First Avenue South. In 2011, parking meters were installed along Central Avenue between 7th and 10th Streets. They were also installed on 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th Streets for one block north and south of Central Avenue. That installation was once considered the first step to placing meters throughout the downtown, but the council never moved forward with placing additional meters. Revenue from the meters paid for repairing downtown parking lots. The proposal before the council would take $25,000 annually from Main Street, Fort Dodge, to pay for parking lot reconstruction and repair. The proposal would impose the two-hour limit on weekdays as well as weekends. It would also ban parking on downtown streets between 2 a.m. and 5 a.m. Also on Monday, the council will consider awarding a contract to place artificial turf on the baseball diamond at Harlan and Hazel Rogers Sports Complex. Mid-America Golf and Landscape Incorporated of Lee Summit, Missouri, submitted the apparent low bid of about $1.4 million. Back to a Reg Bryce story. Ride brings out humor and determination in bicyclists. The Donner Party offers comical warning to slow riders. There's a picture of several people who make up the Donner Party. Paige Nemrick, Abby Pocklington, Dale Nemrick, Steve Urey, Dalton Nemrick, Brooke Nemrick, Maya Hakes, Gail Nemrick, and Greg Nemrick of the Donner Party Reg Bryce team. They're standing in front of a trailer that says Donner Party on the side. Monday brought thousands of bicyclists to Fort Dodge with tents popping up all over town. These camps were full of interesting people from all over the country and each with their own stories. One camp housed the Donner Party, whose camp promised they would eat the slow ones. Abby Pocklington from the Quad Cities area, one of the party's riders, said, "My great uncle lives on Donner Lake, so they were sitting out there one night talking about what their team name should be, and they came up with the Donner Party and the slogan, 'We eat the slow ones.'" Pocklington's family began participating in Reg Bryce in 2000 and enjoyed it so much they convinced several family members to join in the years after. "It's like our family vacation we do every year." Family members travel from several different states, including Pennsylvania, Arizona, Indiana, New Jersey, and California. The Donner Party consists of 25 registered riders and 2 support members this year. Pocklington said their family has some requirements before you're allowed to participate in Reg Bryce. "The rule in our family is you have to be 13 to go on Reg Bryce, and you have to be able to make it up 7th Street Hill by Grandpa's house." Members of the Donner Party range from age 13 all the way up to 77. Fort Dodge Middle School also offered its green space to hundreds of riders, but one rider may have caught a few second glances while rolling his wheelchair around camp. 2021 marks the 15th time Jim Stockbridge from Colorado has ridden in Reg Bryce. Each time, Stockbridge trades his wheelchair for a hand cycle. Stockbridge said, "I broke my neck in 1972 and I'm still partially ambulatory, just not well. But as I age, I know it's hard for you to believe that I'm old, he joked. I progressively am losing more function. Stockbridge said he continues to do this ride as a benchmark of his wellness. If I can still do this more or less, then I still feel like I'm winning the battle against my disability, he said. Despite the added difficulty Stockbridge faces in completing Ragbrai, he and his two riding partners, Mike Simons and Gary Bell of Pennsylvania, were full of jokes and had several other riders laughing throughout the camp. And again, with this article, there are lots of different pictures of Ragbriars enjoying the city. Lots of Ragbriars riding into town. There's a picture of Roger Netz as he plays music on Central Avenue for Ragbrai riders and spectators. And there's another picture of Drake Fox of the Out-of-Staters Bike Club, Mike Simons, Jim Stockbridge, and Gary Bell as they camp at the Fort Dodge Middle School during their stay overnight in Fort Dodge. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, yet another Ragbrai article in today's Messenger. Actually, just a picture. It's a picture of downtown Fort Dodge, which was packed with Ragbrai riders, spectators, and community members on Monday afternoon. And I can't quite tell where this picture originated, but it's looking all the way back up Central Avenue towards 12th Street, and it is quite the mess of humanity. So Ragbrai has come and gone through Fort Dodge, and they have moved on to the next community. Head back to the main page of the Messenger. I'll click where it says More Local News, and we'll see if they have any extra articles there for us to read. Seeing none, we're going to go ahead and click on From Our Files. From Our Files will take us back 15 years ago to 2006. There's a picture of Fort Dodge firefighter Pat Grieve as he gives oxygen to Ginger, a 10-year-old mixed-breed dog, after she was rescued from a house fire at 2540 10th Avenue North that started after a pile of clothing ignited next to the water heater. One person, Jacob Guerin, was transported to Trinity Regional Medical Center suffering from smoke inhalation. Ginger was transported to the veterinarian by family members. We'll switch over next to the Messenger editorial or opinion page. Iowa's fruit and vegetable growers deserve recognition, and that is the editorial in today's Messenger. There's more than corn and soybeans growing in Iowa's rich soil. Iowa's farmers grow staggering amounts of corn and soybeans, so it makes sense that those crops are the first ones many people associate with state farms. But there is also a surprising amount of fruits and vegetables grown in Iowa. To recognize that fact, Governor Kim Reynolds has proclaimed this week as Iowa Fruit and Vegetable Week. The proclamation states in part that local Iowa fruit and vegetable producers receive support and recognition for their achievements by celebrating this week across Iowa. Fruits and vegetables raised by the state's professional horticultural industry contribute $48 million to the state's economy every year. According to a recent statewide survey, the top fruit and vegetable crops in Iowa are tomatoes, pumpkins, cucumbers, green beans, and winter squash. There are more than 1,000 Iowa farms growing vegetables and a similar number growing fruits, according to the most recent U.S. agricultural census. Unless you have your own garden, you're not going to get fruits and vegetables that are more local than those grown on Iowa farms. Elsewhere in the United States, people may talk about the wonders of farm-to-table produce. Here in Iowa, we have it, and we should take advantage of it. That $48 million annual contribution to the Iowa economy is just as healthy in its own way as the fresh fruits and vegetables themselves. We salute Iowa's fruit and vegetable growers and urge everyone to support them by buying fresh, healthy produce. And that is today's Messenger editorial. We're going to go ahead and head over to the Webster City Daily Freeman Journal. Ready for company. Oops, is the title of the first article from the Daily Freeman Journal. Thousands of bicyclists are making their way through Webster City on Tuesday as part of the annual Ragbrite Cross State Tour. This is the third time in the past 10 years that Ragbrite has visited Webster City. In 2012, the community hosted the riders for an overnight stay. In 2015, the city was a pass-through town. Riders will spend Monday night in Fort Dodge before heading out for Iowa Falls. Webster City is one of the communities the bicyclists will ride through on the way to their next overnight destination. The route through Webster City would bring riders into town via James Street to Grove Street and then to 2nd Street due to the street construction. The theme for Webster City is Wheelie Colorful, featuring a logo with a tandem bicycle. The Hospitality Committee has been busy this week sprucing up areas of the community, putting up welcome signs and Burma Shave style signs on Old Highway 20 and along James Street. Welcoming and waving to the bicyclists this morning were members of the Rotary Club who gathered with music and signs. Downtown, riders will find a variety of food vendors and other attractions. The American Legion is operating a beer garden and providing food for hungry cyclists. A semi-trailer was brought into service as a stage for musicians scheduled to perform this morning. Lyft WC, the nonprofit organization that is renovating the former Elks building, took on the task of lining up a slate of entertainment. Darcy Swone, a member of the Lyft WC board of directors, said nearly all the musicians performing are local entertainers. Lyft WC always tries to recognize local talent, and previously many of these performers have entertained at our music nights and at the end of summer block party, Swone said. What better way to welcome the people to Webster City than with some wonderful local talent? The artist lineup includes the Tucker Judkins Trio, Ismael Gomez, Shannon Swone, Forefront, Leo Lovesong, Clint Rydell, and Humble Beginnings. Entertainment was to begin at 8:15, with the last act scheduled to perform at 1 o'clock. Organizers said the first riders were expected into Webster City between 6:30 and 7 a.m., and the last riders were expected to move on to the next destination by 1 o'clock. Officials said the streets and intersections that were closed for the event should reopen about 2 o'clock. Picturing the Past is the title of the next article. A new photo murals offer a glimpse into a simpler time. There's a new photo mural installed at the former Elks building, part of a wheat paste mural project connected to the Fort Pan, Iowa Photo Archiving Initiative, according to this information. From the article, three new large photo murals have been installed in downtown Webster City, giving area residents a look back at life in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Artists Isaac Campbell and Peyton Smith worked through the weekend to install the three large format photographs using wheat paste to adhere the murals to the west wall of the RSVP Senior Citizens Community Center, a window at the former Elks building, and windows at 600 2nd Street. This project has been almost 3 years in the making, Campbell said. He received a grant from the Iowa Arts Council to install the wheat paste murals in 5 different Iowa communities, including Webster City. We were supposed to start in 2019 and 2020. There's a lot of planning involved, talking to communities, getting people going, he said, and then COVID hit. Despite the delays from the pandemic, the timing of the mural installation has worked out well, according to Campbell, and on Tuesday, the murals have their biggest audience as Ragbrite passes through the community. The mural project was designed to highlight the photographs of the Fort Pan, Iowa archive. According to the Fort Pan, Iowa website, Fort Pan, Iowa features curated historical photos taken by ordinary Iowans over the 19th and 20th centuries. The photos represent the personal, whimsical, poetic, significant, and accidentally artistic moments of everyday Iowa life and tell a rich story of Iowa's great diversity and complexity. The aim of the Fort Pan, Iowa program is to find and digitize photographs that might disappear or be thrown away and organize them into a searchable visual chronology, the website states. The Kendall Young Library serves as a Fort Pan, Iowa scanning hub, adding old photos to the collection. Two of the three new murals depict photographs from the McMurray Collection from the Kendall Young Library. The McMurray Collection has fantastic images, Campbell said. I'm really excited to highlight the local history as well as Iowa's collective history. Campbell said the locations that would offer the greatest visibility were chosen for the murals. We went for street corners and windows along the busy 2nd Street, but the RSVP building wall was the first building that we knew we had to use, he said. Campbell said the wheat paste process involves slathering the paste on the wall or window, applying the large panels of photos, and applying another coat over the photo. The sticky paste becomes like glue, hydrates the paper, and creates a seal on top and on the back of the photo. The paper is just regular copy machine paper, but for this project, the artist said the murals are created using 3-foot by 25-foot rolls of paper, allowing them to install the piece with fewer creases and seams. That means they will be more resistant to the elements. It's an art form that invites anyone to participate, he said, of the wheat paste work. It takes no special skills. You don't have to be an artist. If you can move a paintbrush, you can do wheat paste, Campbell said. At the 600 2nd Street location, the artist has posted an explanation of the exhibit. How do we begin to heal our hearts after more than a year filled with loss, grief, depression, anxiety, fear, separation, and loneliness? For many of us, the pain of lost memories and abandoned moments together still linger. Just like memories themselves, the pasted murals made from paper, flour, and water will disappear over time. Some may be ripped away by a violent thunderstorm until the faces become Others may slowly fade until the faces become unrecognizable, the artist noted. This period has made clear the incessant march of time, and with it the ephemerality of our time together. We cannot return to our distracted, disconnected behaviors of the past. We must change. Maybe, just maybe, part of the solution to healing our hearts is as simple as getting back together. The Hamilton County Pheasants Forever, Boone Valley Isaac Walton and Hamilton County Ducks Unlimited will host the annual youth shoot on Wednesday, July 28th from 4:30 to 7:30. The event will be held at the Boone Valley Isaac Walton League Park and is open to young people ages 8 through 16. A parent or guardian must accompany the youth, according to organizers, and a light meal will be provided. Ready for takeoff is the title of the next article. 130 vets are getting ready to take an honor flight on August 28th. The Brushy Creek Area Honor Flight is preparing to take off once again. After missing 3 trips due to the pandemic, the local nonprofit organization is poised to take about 130 area veterans to Washington, D.C. on August 28th. It's a go, said Ron Newsom, the founder and president of the Brushy Creek Area Honor Flight. The veterans will aboard the flight. We'll visit the World War II Memorial, the Korean War Veterans Memorial, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, the United States Navy Memorial, the U.S. Marine Corps War Memorial, and the Air Force Memorial. They will also witness the changing of the guard at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Arlington Cemetery. The upcoming trip will be the 20th Brushy Creek Area Honor Flight since 2010. It's just so rewarding, Newsom said. To a person, I don't think there's a veteran out there that didn't say they had a good time. The pandemic wiped out 3 flights, 2 that were scheduled for last year and the 1 set for this past May. Veterans who signed up to go on the May 2020 trip were the first ones invited to the upcoming flight. Newsom said everyone going on the August 28th flight will have to be vaccinated against the coronavirus. He said 132 veterans will be on the flight. The group includes 1 World War II veteran, 6 to 8 veterans of the Korean War. The rest are all Vietnam War veterans. Those veterans are from 33 counties in northwest and north central Iowa, according to Newsom. They will be accompanied by Honor Flight volunteers, a physician, and 3 nurses. The flight aboard a Sun Country Airlines 737 will depart from Fort Dodge Regional Airport early in the morning. It lands at Dulles International Airport in the Virginia suburbs of Washington, D.C., and is to return to Fort Dodge late that night. Auditions are underway for the Webster City Community Theater season opener, 110 Stories. There are roles for 12 adults, including 7 males and 5 females. Production dates for 110 Stories are September 10th, 11th, and 12th as a tribute on the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center. According to director Louine Getter, the play will be performed as a staged reading of the script written by Sarah Tuft. It is based on interviews with a mother, photojournalist, iron worker, chiropractor, homeless man, and others who saved lives that day. The playwright wove together the stories of 9/11 not shown on the news. Their unflinching, freaked out, and occasionally funny accounts take us back to when 9/11 was unimaginable, shocking, and horror-filled. It captures the resilience of New York City in its aftermath and humanizes history to reveal our compassionate natures. Again, it will be presented on September 10th, 11th, and 12th. Nonprofit arts organization Legacy Learning Boone River Valley will be hosting the gallery showing Art Local July 16th through July 30th. 6 artists originally from Webster City will be featured. Platinum Connect, a new business in town, will provide the space for the gallery showing at 622nd Street from 5 to 7 p.m. each evening. This is an opportunity to see world-famous first-class artists and their work. You'd expect to go to Chicago, London, or Paris to view these works this month. They will be in Webster City, a town they lived in or still live in, said Lindsay McCormick, Welch Legacy Learning Boone River Valley board member. The artists include mixed media artist Roxanne Holosi, painted drawings artist Joanne Hendricks, metal sculpture and pottery artist Maureen Siemens, clay sculpture artist Madeline Loring Vory, sculpture artist Tim Adams, and pottery artist Man Ho Billy Cho. This event is made possible by local business sponsors Platinum Connect, Interior Spaces, Save Your Town, and Produce Station Pottery and Ice House Gallery. A story from the Hamilton County Fair. It was Dog Obedience Day at the Hamilton County Fair, and there were many wagging tails and exclamations of good dog as Hamilton County 4-H'ers put their canine partners through the paces in the show arena. The 4-H program offers young people a chance to learn how to teach their dogs to walk on a leash, sit, and stay. Come on Command, Donna Moore and Virgin Monthy have served as the project superintendents for several years, along with Assistant Superintendents Taylor Johnson and Cassie Siegel. They help the young handlers teach the dogs to pay attention and to follow instructions. Moore said this year there are 25 participants and 27 dogs involved in the obedience program. Training sessions begin in the spring with participants and their animals meeting weekly to work through the exercises, but the handlers also work with their dogs on their own throughout the year, practicing what they learn in the training sessions. In the fair competition, the obedience lots are divided up according to experience, both for the handler and the animal. For example, the beginner's novice A class is designed for dogs and handlers both in their first year of obedience training. Animals in the class are judged on their ability to heel on leash, sit for examination on leash, and recall while on leash. The dog must also sit and stay for 1 minute while the handler walks around the ring. As the dog and handler advance in the training, the required elements become more difficult. Dog obedience participants can also take part in showmanship, testing their knowledge about their dogs and how to handle them in the show arena. The rally events take handlers and dogs through a course of stationary exercises, following a series of commands through the course. For the novice class, that's 10 to 15 different stations. For the advanced participants, it increases 12 to 17 stations. Miley Mason, a member of the Freedom Flickers 4-H Club, said she decided to get involved in the Dog Obedience Project area because her sister had been involved in it. She's in her second year of the program. She's working with a yellow lab named Sophie. Sophie's doing good and likes the training, Mason said. Oriole is Amanda Laura's canine partner, a member of the Cass Red Cardinals 4-H Club, Lars said she was having fun in the project area with Oriole. All my brothers showed stuff at the fair and I didn't have any animals to show, so I decided to show my dog, she said. Both girls said they enjoyed working with their dogs and getting to see the other dogs in the program. You're listening to the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. And now we will turn to today's obituary page. Alan Lee Simpson. Alan Lee Simpson, 43, of Fort Dodge, died Saturday, July 24th at University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics in Iowa City following a short illness. Services will be 11 a.m. Thursday, July 29th at Faith Baptist Church in Fort Dodge. A time of gathering for family and friends will be from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. on Thursday at the church. Gunderson Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Pomeroy, Leslie Junkman. Leslie A. Junkman, age 61, of Pomeroy, died Saturday, July 24th at University of Iowa Hospitals in Iowa City. Memorial services are 10:30 Saturday, July 31st at Hope United Methodist Church in Pocahontas. Visitation is 4 to 6 Friday at Powers Funeral Home in Pocahontas. Powers Funeral Home is handling arrangements. And that is it for today's obituary page. Heading back to the Daily Freeman Journal, Hamilton County has seen an uptick in COVID cases. The health department was following 28 cases as of July 21st. Hamilton County is seeing an uptick in positive COVID-19 cases, and this week the positivity rate has climbed to 15.9%. Right now, the health department is following 28 cases, said Shelby Kruna, Hamilton County Public Health Administrator. That doesn't sound like a lot, but the biggest concern, just like across the rest of the United States, is that 99% of the positive cases are unvaccinated people. The majority of people who positive cases fall into the age 50 and younger category, and nearly all the people I followed up with are not vaccinated either because they don't fall into the age category or they have chosen not to be vaccinated yet, she said. She said there have been a couple of people who have been vaccinated who tested positive in the past month. One was not fully vaccinated and one was fully vaccinated. That seems to be on the rare side, though. The test Iowa sites are no longer offering in-person testing, but Kruna said home test kits are available at the health department or online at Test Iowa website. The kits, which test a person's saliva for the virus, are then mailed to the lab for testing. She said some pharmacies are offering a home test kit that is not a state-identified kit. If people have purchased kits and are using those at home, the results don't get recorded into our database, she said. Those results are not reported to the health department. The CDC said this month that the Delta variant, which is highly transmissible, is now the dominant coronavirus strain across the country. Kruna said that symptoms of the Delta variant are the same as reported for the original virus: persistent cough, headache, fever, sore throat, loss of taste or smell. The CDC is recommending the same general public health measures: masks for the unvaccinated, frequent hand washing, staying home when ill, being fever-free for 24 hours before returning to work, and avoid large crowds if you don't know who has been vaccinated. People who have been vaccinated who then have a breakthrough case will likely see such much milder symptoms, she said. People may wonder, why get the vaccine if I can still get COVID-19? You're still protecting people who can't get the vaccine due to an underlying health condition, she said, and it offers the vaccinated person some protective factors. Without it, you may have gotten very ill with the vaccine instead of just experiencing mild symptoms. Vaccine is still available through the health department's Wednesday's clinics or at Thrifty White Pharmacy or the Hy-Vee Pharmacy. It's still super important to get the vaccine, she said. It's our number one fighting mechanism for this virus and the variants. A voluntary annexation request from Ravi's Farms was approved by the City Council in Webster City following a public hearing and verbal objections from three property owners near the proposed annexation. This is the second time the council has addressed the annexation request from Ravi's Farms for property located south of the city. The first request came to the council at a May 17th public hearing. At that time, the city also proposed to include several acres of property by involuntary annexation, including two residential properties owned by Doug and Pam Ryan and Mark and Peggy Roberts. According to a memo from Planning Director Carla Wetzler, in line with state code, additional territory comprising not more than 20% of the land area may be included in the application without the consent of the owners to avoid creating an island or to create more uniform boundaries. At the May hearing, the council declined to make a motion to proceed with the annexation at that time. The new proposed annexation request admits the Ryan property but would still include the Roberts home. The Ryans submitted a written opposition to the proposal and also appeared in person to voice their concerns. While my wife and I appreciate the voluntary annexation proposal from Ravi's Farms Incorporated that leaves our property outside the ascribed territory, we still stand in opposition to this annexation, he said. We do not want to be surrounded by a housing development. He reiterated many of the points he had voiced in his email objection to the council. He said that approval of the annexation resolution is simply a method to increase property tax revenue. He also objected to many of the population projections included in the city's comprehensive plan, saying the projections were flawed. Roberts also voiced his opposition to the annexation resolution. He said his biggest complaint was that he couldn't connect to any of the city's amenities, such as water and sewer. We're just not going to get any benefit, he said. Roberts also said going from county tax to city tax would more than double. Property owner Gina Monroe, who owns 40 acres in the area but not within the proposed annexation area, said she too was concerned about having to look out over a housing development from her property. Councilman Logan Welch asked if the Robert property could be carved out of the plan annexation as the Ryan property was. He suggested removing two parcels of land from the involuntary annexation belonging to the state of Iowa and Catherine Finucane. There's an opportunity to leave the Roberts out in the county still acquire all the Ravi's land, he said. Welch also pointed out that the city council failed to pass the previous annexation resolution, so that shows me that this is not that important, he said. Councilman Brian Miller said he disagreed with Welch. We didn't have what we wanted in front of us at the time, Miller said. They brought us back what we wanted. I'm a little frustrated because we left that meeting asking for exactly what we've gotten tonight. Miller said even if the Roberts property could be carved out of the involuntary annexation, he doubted they would be happy because the rest of the surrounding property would be included in the annexation. It goes back to we need to do what is best for the city, not what is popular, Miller said. Miller moved to approve the annexation request. Welch cast the only no vote. The City Council of Webster City awarded contracts for several city projects during its regular session. The contract for the 2021 bridge repair projects was awarded to Jasper Construction Services Incorporated of Newton, one of three bids received for repair work to the Overpass Drive Bridge on the western edge of 2nd Street and the 2nd Street Bridge over the Boone River. Jasper Construction turned in the low bid of $133,565. We had wished the bids had come in a little less than they did, said Public Works Director Ken Wetzler. Obviously, we need to keep up with the bridge repair as best we can. The prices today for materials are higher than we've ever seen. The engineer's estimate for the project was $115,000. The bridge project is expected to be finished by October 31st. A contract for the 2021 River Street Water Main project was awarded to Wunsch Construction Incorporated of Green. A total of five bids were received, with Wunsch Construction turning in the low bid of $387,000+. The bid came in below the engineer's opinion of the probable cost, which is $454,000. The project involved the installation of about 2,500 feet of ductile iron water main, water service lines, and new fire hydrants. The completion date was set for October 15th. The Edgewood Water Main Loop project was also considered at Monday's meeting. The council voted to award the contract to GM Contracting Incorporated of Lake Crystal, Minnesota, which, with the only bid submitted of $388,000+. The project involves the installation of 640 feet of water main from the city maintenance facility on East Ohio Street, going under the Union Pacific Railroad tracks to Edgewood Drive. The project is expected to be completed around mid-November. The council also approved a contract with Mustang Disaster Cleanup of Ellsworth in the amount of $15,000+ for mold remediation at the Depot Museum and the First Hamilton County Courthouse, both located at Wilson Brewer Park. Officials said that mold was found in the basement of both buildings. The council also approved the third and final reading of the proposed sewer rate increase, which calls for a 2% increase each year on the base and volume rates, as well as implementing a new surcharge. Finance Director Dodie Wolfgram said that the surcharge would be used to help pay for capital improvements with the sewer utility, primarily for the new wastewater treatment plant. The new wastewater treatment plant is expected to cost between $30 to $40 million or more, she told the council at the July 6th meeting. The surcharge will also be used to pay back an internal loan for the purchase of the land where the treatment plant will be located. The new sewer rates will begin to appear on the customers' utility bills in August. The council also approved the increase to water rates for city customers. At the July 6th meeting, the council removed the proposed surcharge from the water rate increase, which will go into effect in January. The water rates will see a 50% increase to the base rate and a 15% increase in the volume rate. The second year would bring a 15% increase to the volume rate, with a 2% increase slated for years 3 and 4. We're going to head over next to the lifestyle page. A special birthday celebration honoring Bonnie Hoverston is planned for her 90th birthday on Saturday, August 1st. The fun, food, and fellowship begins in the activity room of Trinity Lutheran Church on Kathy Lane and runs from 3 to 5. Those attending are asked to use the northeast door. Again, that's a 90th birthday party for Bonnie Hoverston. Led by Madeline Vorey, Legacy Learning Boone River Valley will host a coral reef sculpture workshop on July 26th from 6 to 8 at Produce Station Pottery on Seneca Street. Participants will create a sculptural coral reef using the clay pinch method of hand building, create starfish, rocks, coral, seaweed, fish, sea turtles, mermaid. The possibilities are endless. After creating, we will use an underglaze to paint your piece. All ages are welcome. Class tuition is $20 plus a $10 firing fee. Participants can enroll by visiting the Legacy Learning Boone River Valley website, which is www.llbisinboyrbisinvictor.org. A reminder, after nearly 18 months of silence, the Fort Dodge Choral Society will present a free concert at 3 o'clock on Sunday, August 1st at Grace Lutheran Church in Fort Dodge. The concert, entitled Silence No More, celebrates the group's return to singing and a belated greeting for Ludwig von Beethoven and his 250th birthday. Webster City residents Mark Andrew, Travis Balt, Stephanie Hill, Alan Youngkliss, and Karen Youngkliss are members of the choir. Conductor Bruce Perry of Sac City commented, "The opportunity to sing together is a great joy that we are happy to share with the community. All are invited to this celebration." Admission to the concert, located at 211 South 9th Street in Fort Dodge, is free. The concert will also be streamed to Fort Dodge Choral Society's Facebook page. For more information, visit fdchoralsociety.org. We're going to go ahead and head over to the Marshalltown Times-Republican for more stories, and we'll get that called up here in just a second. The Marshalltown hip-hop principal has been identified as a suspect and is deceased. A former associate principal, well known for his rap videos at Marshalltown High School, has been identified as the man found dead Thursday during the execution of a search warrant in Ames. William E. Terry, 47, worked for the Marshalltown Community School District during the 2020-2021 school year. The Marshalltown Police Department was serving a warrant and conducting an investigation for allegations of sexual exploitation and inappropriate sexual contact with a student when he was found dead Thursday. He was known as the self-proclaimed hip-hop administrator, creating rap songs for Marshalltown students about COVID-19 mitigation efforts in the school district, and even for a remixed version of the MHS school hymn. The Marshalltown Community School District Board of Education accepted Terry's resignation at a special meeting on July 12th. Marshalltown Police Department said it received allegations concerning potential sexual exploitation and inappropriate sexual contact between a former school employee and former student on July 6th. Terry was working in the Marshalltown District at the time the allegations of misconduct occurred. Marshalltown Police Chief Mike Tupper said the investigation is ongoing and there are no other suspects. It is important for us to make sure all questions are answered, our work is documented, and we have completed the work before we close this case, he said. We are not pursuing prosecution, but there are still leads to follow up on. This marks the third investigation of inappropriate sexual conduct to become public, following two other arrests and one other death of a Marshalltown school employee in the past month. On June 30th, 26-year-old physical education teacher Mark Edward Ferris Esquivel was arrested for sexual exploitation of a 17-year-old student. Within the following week, a Miller Middle School English teacher, 42-year-old Adam Edgington, was arrested for sexual exploitation of a 13-year-old student. According to criminal complaints within the case, Edgington was accused of inappropriate sexual contact with the student. Shortly following his arrest, he was found dead. Tupper said there are no other cases involving school employees that his department is working on. The school district is cooperating fully with the investigation. We have safe schools. I am very confident sending my children here. I am proud to be a Bobcat parent, and I encourage parents to support the school district. The Marshall County Courthouse is getting a new contractor. The county is not expected to be back in the courthouse in 2021. First Onsite is no longer the general contractor for the Marshall County Courthouse renovation, and Auditor Nan Benson said the county will meet with a couple of other contractors to try to secure their services. We hope to meet with both of them this week and have it on the agenda for Tuesday's meeting, she said. Because of the contractor switch and work still to be done, Benson does not think the county will return to the courthouse by December 31st. I don't think December 31st has been a good deadline for a while, she said. I am hoping it will be February or March. Friday was the last day for First Onsite, said, and Benson said the administration of the company intends to stay on board for a while longer to ensure a smooth transition. She also said First Onsite did not want to sign an updated contract with the county, which included liquidated damages. During a July 9th Marshall County Board of Supervisors meeting, the county determined to hold the contractor's feet to the fire with $3,000 liquidated damages per day. That plus the project manager had some health issues and was not going to return were the final nails in the coffin, Benson said. She stressed work will continue on the courthouse during the transition. Subcontractors working on the project will continue their duties. We talked to all of them and everyone is staying on, Benson said. They were here the next day and will still be here. Everyone is very supportive. Of course, the Marshall County Courthouse was severely damaged in a tornado in 2018. Governor Kim Reynolds has named Major Matthew Peterson as the new commandant of the Iowa Veterans Home. Peterson's appointment is effective Tuesday and is subject to Senate confirmation. Peterson's 20-year career and 7 deployments in the Marine Corps Infantry have placed him in a wide range of leadership positions spanning 30 countries and 5 continents. Since retiring from the military, he has directed a working ranch and serves as the executive director of a nonprofit organization as well as a high school teacher. He holds an undergraduate degree in philosophy and government from New Mexico State University. He also received a master's degree in political science from Liberty University and another in organizational leadership from Gonzaga University. He is a fifth-generation Iowan from Red Oak. Thanks to 2 decades of leadership in the Marines and an impressive post-retirement career, Major Peterson brings a unique set of qualifications to the Iowa Veterans Home, Reynolds said. He also brings deep appreciation for the military service of the veterans whose care he will oversee. His proven ability and dedication will pay dividends for the home, its staff, and its residents. Peterson replaces Timon O'Yeary, who was relieved of duty in May. The acting commandant between O'Yeary and Peterson was IVH Division Administrator Penny Cutler Bermudez. Go ahead and take a look at the events of this date, July 27th. On this date in 1974, the House began its impeachment of President Richard Nixon, the country's 37th president. On this date, also, in hope through history, President George W. Bush announced a bold initiative international plan to turn the tide against HIV and AIDS amid a devastating humanitarian crisis. In 1953, armistice ended the Korean War hostilities. On this date in 1981, 6-year-old Adam Walsh was abducted. In 1996, on this date, the bombing at the Centennial Olympic Park took place. In 1794, Robespierre was overthrown in France. In 1921, scientists successfully isolated insulin. On this date in 1949, the first commercial jet took its first test flight. And in 1943, Stalin issued Order Number 227, which outlawed cowards. And that's just a handful of things that happened on this date, July 27th. Turning over to the weather forecast as our time together draws to a close. Heat advisory for pretty much most of the state of Iowa, especially on Wednesday. It's going to be hot and humid with heat indexes well over 100 degrees on Wednesday. Temperature high is projected to be 97 degrees. Again, the heat index is 100 plus. 71 and partly cloudy Wednesday night. Thursday, high of 89 under partly cloudy skies, low of 64. Cooling off on Friday, a high of only 84 degrees with a low of 62. A 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms Friday night. Partly cloudy Saturday, high of 86 with a low of 60. On Sunday, sounds like a beautiful day. Clear skies, high of 84 with a low of 57. On Monday, mostly clear, high of 84. Tuesday, also high of 84 under partly cloudy skies. And that's the forecast for the next 7 days or so. That's going to bring us to the end of the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger with considerable help from the Daily Freeman Journal of Webster City and in the Marshalltown Times Republican. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone. Thank you so much for spending this time with me. We hope that you enjoy the podcast made available to you at iowaradioreading.org, and we appreciate your continued support of IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. Again, a heat advisory for the Fort Dodge area and pretty much the whole entire state of Iowa. So especially on Wednesday, you want to take good care of yourselves, stay cool, stay in the air conditioning, drink plenty of water, as they say. Stay cool, stay healthy, take good care of yourselves, and we'll talk to you again real soon right here on IRIS. Bye-bye for now.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed. Food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.